Hello and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are known today as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, and today we have a special episode to celebrate 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and in this program, we will be looking at People's Health Sanctuary, a program that we often have some content around as one of the newest initiatives of the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And joining me now is Dr. Xavier Coughlin.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me on.
Welcome. Can you talk about your role in People's Health Sanctuary and what should listeners know?
Cool. Yeah, thank you so much for highlighting the work. A large experimental program with a lot of people involved. But basically, the People's Health Sanctuary is a community-led mutual aid health initiative based in North Central Troy in the second floor of the new Nature Lab building of the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And our theory of change is based in racial and transformative justice to create a libertarian model of community health care for all. And we're very influenced by different models and experiments across the country and across the world. But personally, I think one of the things that we're very influenced by is the Zapatistas, which is an indigenous group down in Chiapas, talk about healthcare from below and kind of creating a space where we can experiment with what a new type of healthcare and health in its most broad and holistic way of thinking about it could be. And we're excited to start in North Central Troy.
And this idea came from a bit of a collaboration with the community. There was influence there, was there?
Yeah, a few years ago, the sanctuary held a community forum where they were asking kind of what needs the community had. And one need that really came clear was the idea of a place to address trauma, to deal with trauma. And it was also a place to have health and self-care and just kind of like broad topics. And then through a very funny and great series of coincidental meetings, we were trying to start a similar project in another town, and the sanctuary had a space opening through the Nature Lab. And so all those pieces kind of came together, and here we are many years later down the road, hoping to open up the space soon, which under the amazing work of Steve Pierce and many other people, the construction phase is basically over, and we're hoping to start doing monthly kind of forums to introduce the People's Health Sanctuary to the community.
I was just in the space and it's coming together very nicely. You are the co-facilitator of People's Health Sanctuary. You work with a team of people. Who are some people who need to be get mentioned?
Yeah, so the People's Health Sanctuary Council, which is kind of the organizing body that has been over the last couple of years trying to organize the network as well as the space itself, is comprised of different groups that are involved in kind of a variety of holistic health. So we have people from the Capital District Band-Aid Brigade, which is the local street medic group, Fern and Jennifer Baumstein. We have also folks from the sanctuary itself, Branda, Steve Pierce, Mel, who was at the sanctuary and is still continuing her work with the PHS Council. And then Eileen Javier, as well as Kathy High, and as well as Ellie Irons, who's working with the Nature Lab. And Ariella Zamchek has been a huge help. And then my partner, JJ Lucino, as well as myself, and Lisa Good has been a part of our council as well, all trying to bring together these pieces, as well as Dr. Janice Prideboom, who represents the NAACP in Troy as part of our collaborative effort.
So using some Hudson Mohawk Magazine stories to give a better deep dive into some of the ideas that you're working on at People's Health Sanctuary, we're starting with Eileen Javier's interview with Lisa Good. Eileen is very involved and one of the lead facilitators of People's Health Sanctuary, but also a Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer. And this interview with Lisa Good is about ACEs, health disparities, and COVID, and recorded back in 2020.
Hello, Lisa. Welcome back to the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work that you do in our community?
Hello, and thank you for having me back. You guys are like family to me, so this is really great. My name is Lisa Good, and I am the founder of Urban Grief. And the vision of Urban Grief is to really foster resilient and peaceful communities empower to promote healing in the face of crisis. And part of our core mission is to respond to trauma, crisis, and grief by providing comprehensive solutions to individuals and communities. And so a big part of that work is reaching and supporting victims of violence, of community violence in particularly, and homicide survivors, but also a part of my urban grief work and also, you know, some of the training and consulting work that I do is around educating and talking to everyday people. And when I say everyday people, I mean non-clinical people, you know, non-medical people, just about what trauma is, adverse childhood experiences, and resilience and healing, and how those different areas kind of overlap in our lives. That's a little bit about what I do. And I've lived in the Capital Region pretty much all my life, and this is my home, and I have a vested interest in seeing people in my community not just survive, but also thrive and do well.
Can you talk a little bit about compounded grief and how now tragedy can build upon all pain?
You know, so with the COVID-19 and looking at the health disparities specifically related to COVID-19, however, while acknowledging that many of those disparities existed long before COVID-19 came into play, with the onset of COVID-19, part of the impact is that there are many community members feeling multiple layers of loss. They're experiencing multiple layers of loss. And so when you think about a lot of our communities and you think about essential workers and who are the people that are actually on some of these front lines. And when I say front lines, I mean the things, the services that we actually kind of take for granted, like fast food and restaurants and housekeeping staff, the food service staff of mm-hmm. the hospital, the people who register patients at the hospitals. And so I think that when we think about frontline workers, essential workers, we've really kind of have a constricted view of that. And even though media now is kind of acknowledging all of these different service areas, has a part of essential work that is necessary to kind of keep us moving along or keep things operationalized, while they're being recognized, value is not really being assigned to their work. In that regard, they're almost viewed as expendable to some degree. And that is, to me, a loss, right? So you have a job and you have to keep your job because you're glad to have a job because so many people have lost a job. But at the same time, because there's not, we give lip service to the value of what you do and how you are contributing to the sustainability of some semblance of life as we kind of once knew it, you're not given the same value. The same value is not assigned to your sacrifice as it is to the sacrifices of, let's say, doctors or nurses or those kinds of folks. And so that's a loss. But then there are these other losses that are being experienced. The loss of employment, the loss of a stable income, the loss of security that is associated with your housing. So if you're economically distressed because you lost your job and now that jeopardizes your housing, it may jeopardize your transportation if your car is repossessed. And so when we talk about losses, they're layered and they're many, but also the loss of even something, you know, even childcare, right? Childcare access, school, you know, just certain things that we've not taken for granted, but they are part of our everyday life that even in the context of a marginalized community, these are things that help sustain the community and keep people going. And, you know, now all of a sudden in COVID-19, we have the just collapsing of some of these real basic services that and systems that really allow people to survive and have some level of sustainability. And so that's a loss, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to that, there is also this loss of security. So some losses are very tangible and concrete, and then other losses are kind of ambiguous. But the loss of security, the loss of safety, the loss of physical health, and we're not talking about that as much, but we, because so many people have died from COVID, I don't know if we are having conversations around the people who survived COVID and what their lives are like after that, because not everybody goes back to 100% pre-COVID. And so people are experiencing losses around health. They're experiencing losses in relationship to people dying. But even in the context of people dying, not having the opportunity to go and be present, people are experiencing losses around rituals that we have historically had as it relates to death and dying and grieving. So all of these layers of loss are built upon the old trauma and the old pain that exists in a lot of our communities. If there was already, if the networks of support were already stretched, like if the budget was already stretched to the max just to put food on the table or keep a roof over someone's head, you know, and here comes COVID, it doesn't take a lot more pressure for those safety nets, whether they're social, whether they're financial, whether they're spiritual, whether they're emotional, to break, because they were already extended and stretched to the max because of the long-term marginalization and disinvestment in communities because of racism and discrimination, because of the experiences that people have when dealing with healthcare systems.
In addition to physical health disparities that disproportionately affect Black and Brown as well as low-income communities, last time you came to the sanctuary, you talked about the effects of trauma and adverse childhood experiences. Do you think adverse childhood experiences play a role in how people are physically affected by COVID-19?
The high ACE scores are associated with coronary heart disease, stroke risk, asthma, COPD, kidney disease, diabetes, obesity. ACEs play a part in that. And so when you look at the underlying conditions that have been talked about in tandem with the impact of COVID-19 on Black and Brown communities and how they are more at risk because of these pre-existing conditions, I'm saying that the risk for these pre-existing conditions are in part linked to the high adverse childhood experiences that people are encountering within their communities. You know, when someone is under constant exposure to stress and to, you know, to toxic stress, and there is no end in sight, so to speak, that does take a toll on your body. It does take a toll on your health. And high blood pressure is just one example of that's can be very stress sensitive. It is impacted by the constant exposure to stress, and COVID-19 is stressful. So when we think about who's impacted by this, it makes sense.
Is there anything that I haven't asked and you would like to speak about today before we wrap up?
I think that COVID has really changed how we'll do life going forward. And it's important that institutions, organizations, political leaders, particularly the healthcare institution, that they not back away from the glaring racial disparities that exist in terms of how people are treated within the healthcare system, how people are treated within their communities, that no matter what the health crisis may be, whether it's the management of chronic health care, whether it's the mental health impact of COVID, whether it's the grief that results from COVID, I think that none of us can afford to bury our heads in the sand and ignore the tremendous emotional burden that is placed on Black and brown people within our communities, with the racism and the discrimination and just the lack of safety. Right now, in conjunction with having to deal with the fact that Black and brown people have been identified as most impacted, having high death rates, in conjunction with, you know, other healthcare challenges. But with all of that, experiencing the economic impact, experiencing the health impact, experiencing the loss impact, we don't even have space to even really cope and manage with all of that because of the continued racist and discriminatory practices that are directed towards Black and brown people. And it's kind of, I think that we really have to examine ourselves and say, how are we going to create systemic change that will, one, prevent adverse childhood experiences, two, address the institutional biases that perpetuate health disparities, and contribute to the ongoing trauma. So how will we use this moment in time to really not just settle for a Band-Aid approach, but actually push for systemic change that actually allows people, that values all people, and actually allows people to get the help and the support that they need without judgment, without assignment of blame, and with the respect that is due to all people. There's more outrage about a dog being mistreated than there is a human being who goes to the hospital and gets less than inferior care simply because the caregiver is unaware of their implicit bias and what they choose to offer to other people. I just think that this is really a moment in time that institutions, organizations, communities, political leaders need to take a long, hard look about creating systemic change that values all people and that improves the health, quality of life, and well-being for all people and not just a select few.
Yes. Thank you so much for talking to us, and thank you for the work that you do in our community.
Great. Thank you for having me.
This is Eileen Javier, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
So I think what Lisa Good brings up in this interview, especially around health disparities and obviously with COVID, you know, and despite everything you probably read in the news, we are still in a pandemic that is more and more clearly making health disparities seen, especially around racial and socioeconomic lines. And then, you know, even to think like internationally. And I think this, for me personally, as an ER doctor, has been something that I've been very focused on and very inspired to work on, is that oftentimes the way that we view health and healthcare in the US is a very individualized thing. And so we never look at a systemic level of why is it that people who are from a lower socioeconomic class, African-American, Latinx, immigrants, why is it that they suffer so much more from high blood pressure, cancer, heart attack, strokes, you know, every asthma, pulmonary issue. And in modern healthcare, we never look at these kind of larger issues, these like structural issues, which I think is actually what really like fundamentally creates the health that we have. And I think COVID, unfortunately, has only exacerbated that. And now with the rise of kind of a privatization of COVID benefits, it's probably only going to get worse. And so for us, this is like a key element of what we're trying to do, is to create a space that we can start trying to think through this even. And this is where we, as the People's Health Sanctuary, we're not trying to propose answers. And that's why it's very important for us that we're not trying to be a clinic necessarily, because clinics fall under kind of the rubric of Western medicine, where if you have high blood pressure, there's going to be a pill for that. And we really want to get away from that and actually look at more of the structural, you know, how is it the way we build our society that creates inequality, and how are the ways that we as a community can start to actually address those in a holistic manner. And so, we've been very inspired by the work of Lisa Good and Urban Grief, and really highlighting these structural aspects of what's going on in our community.
Our next story is also a story by Eileen Javier. And this story looks at youth suicide prevention.
September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. It's a time to raise awareness on this stigmatized and taboo topic, the topic of suicide. And the Mental Health Association in New York State, a nonprofit organization that works to end the stigma against mental illness and is promoting mental health wellness in New York State. Nichelle, welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me today, Eileen.
How do you get involved in the work of try to prevent suicide?
I lost my son to suicide in 2007. And a year and a half later, I lost my niece to suicide in 2009. She was one of the young ladies in the Schenectady contagion. I didn't want another parent to feel how me and my brother felt for losing our firstborn children or our children at all. So I joined AFSP. I started doing grief and grief groups in the communities, just bringing individuals in the community together because the Schenectady community was hurting and in pain at the time because of the contagion. And that started me wanting to just help healing, help with the healing in Schenectady, as well as for myself. I found that by being there and giving back and talking about my son, I helped others want to talk about their pain and their loss, which in turn helped me with my healing. And I continue to do that today.
And how do you get involved with family education to participate in this webinar?
I currently work as office manager for the crisis prevention team for the Schenectady City School District. And the crisis prevention team is a program that helps bridge students in our district to mental health services in the community. So I currently sit on a task force for the Mental Health Association, pretty much focusing on recommendations, developing recommendations for prevention of Black youth suicide. As we've found that the suicide rates in the Black and Brown communities are rising, and I sit on a task force to try to address some of those issues.
What is exactly a task force?
So a task force is a group of individuals. We can start at professionals, social workers, doctors within New York State, and they are working. First, they are recognizing we have an issue in our Black and Brown communities with suicide, and also how our Black and Brown youth are being looked over. And so this task force or this group of individuals will look at the topic as a whole, figure out how we can address it in different ways, and break off in different groups to start building policies, programs, et cetera, on addressing those issues.
Is this task force available online? I mean, via phone? How a person could contact you in case that they are seeing any changes in their teenager or in, well, it's happening even young children. How can a person will be able to talk to the task force?
Well, if I, as a parent who do have children for who have mental health issues, the task force wouldn't be the place to start. I would start with a mental health professional, a social worker. I would start with talking to your child to see how you can help him. I would start with organizations like American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And there are hotlines. So I would start there because suicide is a serious issue and you want to address it rather quickly than waiting on a task force to get to you. And not saying that no one would respond, but I think those avenues are a lot more immediate for this situation.
Just walking back to your own experience, can you tell what signs you might have seen in your son? I mean, I know that probably the signs you saw after the fact. I mean, I don't know if I'm making sense, but basically,
you are making perfectly sense.
You know
sense.
What I mean? It's kind yes, of after it happened, yes. then you yes. might have realized this happened because of this. That's what I mean. What do you notice in him?
It's funny that you say that, because after my son died, I actually went back to school actually for human resources, and I took a lot of psychology classes and classes with abnormal psych, et cetera. And that's when I realized a lot of the signs I was missing. And it's hard, honestly, if your child's a teenager, sometimes it's hard to determine if it's just a teenager going through their regular hormone shifts or if a child is suffering. That's why it's always important to have conversations with the child and talk to them. Even when they do want to be alone, I tend to not leave my kids. I don't like to leave them alone. I'm always in their face like, hey, what's going on? And they're like, mom, and I'm like, tell me what's going on and I'll leave you alone, you know. But some of the signs that I did see was he reserved. He was, first he was a straight A student honor roll, and his grades just dropped tremendously. And he had no interest in a lot of the things that he loved to do. He would love to be around his family. He was like a big brother. He was a big brother and like a father to his little brother. And after a while, he didn't even want to be around him. In my son's case, he started doing a lot of research on the computer. That's why it's really good to try to follow your kids' web browsers. He was doing some research on the computer, religious research, like he was trying to find a religion. He was trying to find himself. So I'm just trying to think of, those were a lot of the evident signs that I see off the top. I'm being reserved. Love and losing lots of love in a lot of different activities I love. He was a very clean individual, clean, and all of a sudden his room was a mess. He just had no organization whatsoever. So when you start noticing slight changes or big changes in your child, or anyone that you love, it's just good to talk to them. Just be there, let them know that you're there.
Basically, what you're saying is always start the conversations like the talk save lives.
Yeah, why not? Yes.
Is there anything that you would like to say to our parents that are listening or to our youth?
I would like to just tell the parents to take a breath, be easy on yourself. We're all in this together, and there are resources out here for you. I would like to just tell the youth today that there are adults here for you, that this will all pass, to hold on and just reach out to the people that love you and your resources.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, I think the topic of youth suicide, it's a humbling moment, I think, in our society. And, you know, as I work at the Samaritan ER, and our ER, unfortunately, is flooded with, I would say, 11 to 18 year olds who are either actively trying to hurt themselves, very depressed, super anxious, unable to kind of cope with school and with work. And, you know, interestingly, like the New York Times just did on one of their podcasts about the adolescent mental health crisis, which was great that they highlighted it. But I think the way that they tried to answer the question was, I think, only part of the problem, where essentially they're blaming it on like that adolescents are hitting puberty faster and they're just bombarded by social media and, you know, constant comparisons, which I think is a huge part of it. But yeah, I'm really appreciative that this is like a big part of the radio segment, because I'm always reminded by this quote a philosopher said, that in an insane society, and I think most people would say modern Western culture is fairly insane, the only sane answer is to become insane. And so, you know, when we look at our youth, like to me, it feels like this, they are calling out for help, and that the society that we have created for them, you know, how can you blame a teenager at this point for being depressed and anxious when they kind of look at the state of the world that we have created, but also their options? I mean, I'm not a teenager anymore, and I'm actually very curious to hear from teenagers. But when I was a teenager, the idea of like, oh, you know, you can get a job and you'll live and you'll retire, and, you know, maybe go to school, like that seems gone at this point. And many people feel that they will not live as well as their parents did, which creates a lot of senses of anxiety and depression. And then just the way that our society is structured, where you're saddled, if you go to school, you're saddled with debt. And then how are you going to pay with that debt when you can't find a job? Or even just the way the educational system is structured, it doesn't deal with these massive existential issues of meaning, of climate change, of how to like build a life worth living. And so, yeah, to me, this feels like a also key piece of what the sanctuary has been working on over the last, you know, 15 years, but also what the People's Health Sanctuary wants to do is to build a space where we, again, not have any answers to this crisis, but to keep asking better questions. And we would really like to create spaces where youth can take leadership in their own health.
And you are involved with youth groups, right? So the idea is that People's Health Sanctuary becomes a space where people can lead their own movements.
Yeah. Yeah. And what, you know, it's like, it's funny to talk about the People's Health Sanctuary because so often in our like associate medicine, everything has to be kind of formulated. And this is like, this is what our deliverables will be. And one of the things that I've really appreciated of working with this cohort, but also with the sanctuary, is the space to leave things unknown. And so over the next few months, we're hoping to have these community forums where, yeah, we would love to hear from youth about what they would actually like to hear, like what they would like to create. And then how can we create those spaces for them, be it, you know, a listening space, be it an adult free space, be it a space that they can hang out after school, you know, whatever that can look like. Yeah, because clearly there's a crisis going on, and clearly like medicine has no answers for it except to keep giving pharmaceuticals to kids, keep putting them in mental institutions, keep treating it as if it's their problem. And that's just not going to work, I think.
For those of you just tuning in, we're talking about People's Health Sanctuary with Dr. Xavier Coughlin. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine and the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany. Also streaming online at mediasanctuary.org. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. Our next interview is from former intern Sarah Abraham, part of her series around mental health. In this story, she interviewed Nikki Rogers, a yoga activist and teacher, about radical self-care.
Hi, everyone. It's Sarah Abraham. I'm talking with Nikki Rogers. Could you please tell us a little bit about the work that you do and how it ties in with mental health?
Sure. Hi, Sarah. It's so nice to chat with you. So the work I do is under the healing artist umbrella. I'm a yoga activist. I started my journey into my own personal practice of yoga as a mental health practice for myself. I was a special educator in the Albany School District, as well as moonlighting as a cocktail waitress downtown Albany and having a great time in my mid-20s. But I did realize that I was doing what we call burning the candle at both ends. So early mornings and strenuous kind of intense work as a special education person. And then a really up-key type of lifestyle with late nights, early mornings on the other end with the bar restaurant industry. And I've never been a fan of pharmaceuticals. I know there's things to help with stress that are marketed and branded. And I really wanted to know what I could do in terms of modifying my own personal lifestyle. And that led me very naturally to a yoga practice. HeartSpace Albany was the place where I began my practice. And that's also a place where I discover, if this is good for my mental health, it would be great for my students as well.
Wow, that's pretty, that was a nice startup. Like, so for you to like think that yoga is like where you get your best therapy, like your ultimate healing. Like, when I think of yoga, I think of like, I'm Indian, so I just think of like my roots, but then I think of how white people also colonized it a little bit, and they're mainly the teachers. And I just wonder like how you actually found such a connection to yoga to begin with, when you're like, this is the place that I heal.
Beautiful. So yeah. So you guys can't see me, but you might know of me. I am a Black woman. My mother's descendants are from Italy. So white and Black are part of my identities. And it was an interesting space to step into. Yeah. I mean, this is 2000, probably 8 or 9 when I started to practice. And at that point in time, there were 0 other brown faces when I came to practice. For my own personal reasons, I think I tapped into it as a resource and then saw, you know, just from being in the experience of teaching in an urban school district, I quickly attached the healing and the relaxation, the stress relief and the grounding, a sense of centeredness, centered of belongingness to myself and within my body. It was very easy for me to draw a line where my students didn't have those in their toolkit. So it's kind of the way that I walk through life, just looking at what's going on around me, how can I make an impact in a positive way? What's missing here? What can I do? What can I personally offer? So my personal practice quickly shifted into how do I get this certification so that I can offer this to students that are like my own in the urban education setting.
I really appreciate how you said like you want to make an impact and you're here for the people, especially these students that like didn't have the opportunity to try and find like self-acceptance and self like realizing who they are as a person. So when you speak of radical self-acceptance, does that mean like we tend to not accept ourselves for who we are? Or like, what do you think the root of that is?
Wow. Yeah. So there's this idea of surviving as opposition to thriving. So this goes directly into the nervous system. It goes into the way that we're hardwired. And particularly for Black folks in this country, the idea of accepting self and holding worth, just simply being worthy, was eradicated in the process of slavery. Being treated as something rather than as someone, being treated as if there is no value to you other than your capacity to work and perform. And I think that can cross cultures as well. I think that even you could say maybe even within cultures that value work, hard work, study, focus, there can be a shift away from accepting who you are and how you are in the simple fact that you have worth in your being, that the worth is often shifted to your doing. Can you relate to that at all?
Honestly, yeah, like we get so caught up in like society standards of what it means to find worth in yourself. But like you said, the history behind Black Americans and everything that you guys suffered through, and like how everyone has their own testimony and their own story of like being their own person. But for us to even like get to that step of like, you know, I am worth something. Like, what do you think the process is behind that to finally realizing like, this is what I'm worth. And for me being able to have that ability to respect myself in that way, is that just a wake up call? Or do you think it's like a process that happens in a couple of weeks or overnight? Like, what do you think?
I think it's an ongoing process. I think it's there's a constant challenge to our individual worth that is externally imported. We can also externally import some ideas about individual worth, about collective worth. Those ideas have to have the space to be absorbed. So for me, what yoga has done and what I've seen it do, what I know it can do, is it kind of tills the field, right? Because what I felt like in Albany, in our school, was doing 90 different initiatives at one different point federally funded, grant funded, state funded, to increase the rigor and to increase the graduation rates and so on and so forth. But we weren't addressing the fact that we were trying to plant on bedrock. The soil wasn't fertile. Those ideas hadn't been imparted. The underlying wisdom of internal worth and intrinsic worth that has nothing to do with what grade you got or how fast you can run up and down a basketball court or how many girls or guys want to date you. All of those factors that come into play so much in the school age years, without the foundation underneath of you're worthy regardless of all of these things. That's the space where I thought we really need to get under and fertilize that space and just impart those types of ideas so that those seeds can grow, so that the resilience of an individual and the resilience of a collective group can expand, so that, you know, those hits that life is going to throw at you aren't going to knock you down and knock you out. They might push you off course a little bit, but you say, wait a minute, I'm still worthy, and you flow forward, rather than, you know, a term that Brené Brown uses, hustling for your worthiness, thinking I've got to do more, I've got to be busier, I've got to achieve greater in order for the people around me to find value in me. And number one, you have to find the value within yourself, or else you're always seeking it from around you. And if you're seeking that from around you, it can be taken. Mistake that you make that's judged to be, you know, untenable can destroy your sense of self, because you were basing your sense of self off of what the people around you decided you were worth. You have to make that decision inside of yourself and then carry it with you, so that when life kicks you around a little bit, you can hold your ground and or you regain your ground.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Nikki. And I hope you have a great day and enjoy the stretch of the day. Get it?
Thank you so much, Sarah. This is excellent. It's so nice to chat with you.
You have a good one. Thank
you. You too.
Yeah, I think this question of self-care and radical self-care, which I love that term, is so important to talk about. And, you know, again, I think that this is like kind of a fundamental aspect of what People's Health Sanctuary is working to try to answer. And I think especially now, with like yoga and like the wellness kind of industrial complex, they call it, right, has just totally been co-opted by capitalism. I think in many kind of like progressive spaces or left spaces, there's don't worry about taking care of the self, and then people get burned out. We're not able to actually like deal with trauma. We're not actually come to these spaces with like a holistic way of thinking about ourselves. But then, you know, on the other side of it, you have things like, you know, the cultural group model of, you know, you can hack your body and, you know, have this like super expensive crystal for you to find your own individual enlightenment. And I think the little that I kind of am learning more about communities that are more like holistic, there is a self in a larger community. And I think in, you know, capitalism, for example, it's just the self. So it's just you going to your yoga class, just you're eating your organic food. And it doesn't really take into account a system, because also self-care could be, you know, going to Standing Rock. Self-care could also be, you know, fighting with cops. Like self-care can also be all these things that is not like a blissed out, like I'm going to zen out and forget about the world. Self-care could also be fighting, you know, and struggling with the world, for the world that you want to see. And also things around like community purpose, which can only be found with other people. And yes, I think that this is such an important question. You know, we are hoping to have kind of like an integrative space where, you know, say if you had back pain, for example, you know, myself as a Western doctor, I can kind of say like, these are the red flags that we would be concerned about it being something more serious. But also, you know, here are like, I have other practitioners who practice different modalities of health, who can give you a different way of thinking about your back pain. Maybe it's how your trauma from your childhood is stored. Maybe it's your working two jobs and you're just super stressed. And so we need to actually deal with like socioeconomic aspects of it. You know, maybe it's something totally different. And so, yeah, really trying to blend that all together and, you know, for us to find our own self-care in community, I think is like the important thing that that makes me think of when I hear radical self-care, which, yeah, I love the way they're bringing these things together.
And yoga is something that has been culturally appropriated. The original meaning is very much about the deeper understanding and not just the actual practice of stretching, which ties into our next story, looking at Indigenous knowledge. And for this story, Anna Stelton Camp spoke with the program director of the Traditional Native American Farmers Association about teaching holistic approaches and creating sustainable communities.
My name is Clayton Brockupe. I'm the program director for the Traditional Native American Farmers Association. We're based here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I live and work and farm in the Pueblo of Tizuque, which is just north of Santa Fe.
I specifically want to speak about your organization's education program, the Indigenous Sustainable Communities Design Course. Online, it states that this program demonstrates how many disciplines, including natural farming, alternative energy, natural healing, and restoring community, must be integrated into a whole system using nature's model of sustainability and diversity. Can you first speak to the importance of this holistic approach to creating communities of sustainability?
Yeah, I guess what we've seen and what in many places people are experiencing is that if there's a given issue within a community, the approach to, I guess, addressing it has always been very focusing just on one aspect. Mm. Let's say health or diabetes in our communities, right? Mm. And I guess health experts in diabetes will come in and say, well, you know, they say, well, you have to change your diet primarily and take your medication and monitor your diabetes. Mm. So, you know, that seems to work, but it's also more or less sort of a maintenance, not really a fix. Mm. So what we try to do is, how do you integrate that into a complete and holistic living system? One would be change the diet is great. So how do you change your diet? How do you change your lifestyle, I'll say? And ag is one way of doing that. There's other ways of doing it too, but agriculture will hopefully produce a healthier diet for you, learn the physical activities, but also, like I was saying earlier, that quality time with your family, all of that becomes part of a larger, I guess, living system. You can do that with your family. You can also do it with a community within your community, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that we had tried to do actually as a younger family was to grow as many things as we needed to have a healthy diet. So we did that for a few years, but what we're finding out is if you have more people in your community or in your extended family gardening or farming like that, some of them are sort of specialized in growing some of the crops. Actually, we found out one of our grandsons is really, really good at growing tomatoes. Mm. And so we leave it up to him to grow those tomatoes and a few other things, and we grow other things like that. So that becomes like where he is able to grow a lot of tomatoes was closer to his home because of the climate we have here. Tomatoes require a little bit more water and a little bit more attention to grow them successfully. So what we did was created what they call biointensive gardens close to his house. We've been collecting water off of the roofs of his house, and that's, one way of addressing a lot of different challenges that we have. So it becomes more of a living system, a sustainable system.
So would you say that your example of combating diabetes through agricultural practices where you can spend time not only exercising, but spending time with family is an example of the importance of taking more natural healing approaches rather than just taking a pill, but not addressing the more fundamental issues of those problems.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, my wife had worked in the field of diabetes prevention for a number of years, and she's not doing it anymore, but that's what she had been, I guess, promoting. But, you know, we have to be careful, too, not to say, well, don't be taking those pills. You know, they have their place, I'll say, but with diet and exercise becoming more of a pattern, I'll say.
Mm.
And that's a way of maintaining a healthy lifestyle. And we've seen it over and over that when people do embrace that, the insulin or the pills and stuff like that are no longer required.
So before we end the call today, is there anything else you would like to discuss or share?
I'm not sure who the audience is, but one of the big focuses, I guess, back to our Farmers Association when it was originally thought of and formed was ways of developing, I guess, the interests with youth.
Mm.
And I think we've been very successful at that. And I think it's not that they weren't interested. It's just like they were never given, the opportunity or the encouragement to look at gardening or farming as part of a lifestyle or part of their education or their upbringing. We see that now, especially this year, for some reason, with the pandemic, I guess people had concerns and apprehensions around where is their food going to be coming in from. And so we've seen a huge surge in home gardens, resurgence in farms like ours. We actually increased our production a little bit. And the people that have the energy is young people.
Mm.
And they really stepped up and wanted to learn as much as they could and as quickly as possible, you know. And, you know, that's something that we've been wanting to see. And it took, you know, a real crisis in order for it to happen. And what I'm hoping for is that this won't become just a fad, but it'll become something that is ongoing and is as natural as anything else, that growing food in and around your home or around your community will be, you know, something we'll see continuing to grow in the future, and that the young people will be a major part of that.
Right. I feel that the COVID pandemic made people very aware that there's such a disconnect between most consumers and who's producing their food that they merely see the empty shelves in the grocery store and have no idea what else is happening in the food system, that fear and apprehension really came out during COVID.
Well, you've seen in a lot of instances where that the current conventional food system fractured and did create that awareness of the weakness of that food system. So everyone needs to be, I guess, a part of that solution. Young, old, urban, rural, all of it. With that design course you talked about a little bit earlier, is actually, we've been doing that since 1996, and a lot of really interesting and successful urban projects emerge from that. That's another aspect that I'd like to see continue happening.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, I love this question, even of like, what would it mean to be in a holistic community or a sustainable community? And, you know, if I could be completely honest, it's like, I actually think we don't know what that would be. We cannot remember it. We actually have no, we can't have an imagination for it. And so I think it's always helpful for us to be surrounded by people who still hold that imagination. And I think this also works a lot with, like, you know, even like decolonial studies. And, you know, myself, as my mom is from Peru, but our family is actually from Okinawa, from like pre-Japan Okinawa. And then my dad is Irish and Scottish. And so, you know, there's like a lot of movement in like decolonial studies of not focusing on the nations and the indigenous folks in your area, but actually like for to go back to our roots, because by learning about our roots, we are less likely to appropriate and to take take systems of living that are not, you know, actually ours to understand. And this is a huge task. Like, you know, I don't have any answers for this. And our best hope is that the People's Health Sanctuary can be a space where we can ask these questions of what would it be to live in a post-capitalist or non-capitalist way of living? What would it be to live in a holistic society? And for me personally, you know, I traveled to indigenous communities down in Mexico, and that was a huge influence for me of like blending Western kind of like science and medicine, but also like a much more earth-based and community-based way of being. But that was also very difficult. Like it wasn't utopia. It was a huge struggle, and it was humbling to see the struggle that they had to go through to maintain their kind of lifestyle. And the Zapatistas have this phrase, which I love, this, let's walk while questioning. And I think especially in this kind of, you know, as we are facing kind of the collapse of so many structures around us, how do we go into an unknown, into a place that most of us have no knowledge of, together with people who do, and let them lead us, but also for us to ask ourselves of where is it that we come from and what is it that we can bring to that conversation.
And that last story was also talking about agriculture, and People's Health Sanctuary is a part of Nature Lab, which we had our special with Kathy High and Ellie Irons yesterday. And part of Nature Lab is also the Collard City Growers. How are all of these systems working together? And before we run out of time, what other aspects of People Health Sanctuary have we not touched upon?
Yeah, I think food and agriculture are just a huge piece of the whole puzzle on thinking of like a holistic environment of, you know, how is it that the tomato that we eat feeds us, it nourishes us, but then also thinking of how is it that we nourish the tomato, you know, by our dying, by our excrement, by our breathing into the world. So thinking of more of this like interaction between ourselves. So, and you know, then on a material level, you know, the North Central Troy area, which is like classified as a quote food desert, where there's just no supermarkets around. So the only places around are bodegas that have just highly processed food. And it's very difficult to eat healthy in that way. And so I think talking about food is such a huge piece of it. You know, you go to these fancy organic, you know, farm to table restaurants that are totally inaccessible to most people living in the U.S. And I think, you know, say like the work of Soulfire is really trying to reclaim that knowledge, reclaim those skills, and really kind of fight against that kind of commodification and that objectification. And so those are huge pieces of what we are trying to create space for.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today for Hudson Mohawk Magazine. That is all the time that we have today. I'm Sina Bazila Hickey, joined today by the incredible Dr. Xavier Coughlin, who is one of the lead facilitators over at People's Health Sanctuary. This is a volunteer-run program, and we appreciate everybody who makes this show possible. Thank you for celebrating 5 years of Hudson Mohawk Magazine with us. And if you'd like to get involved, please email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or go to mediasanctuary.org to find an extensive archive. Some keywords for People's Health Sanctuary are health, People's Health Sanctuary, food systems, food deserts, trauma. There's so much to explore. We appreciate you. Thanks for listening.